For some, the idea of travelling or escaping the daily grind can fill us with much hope, a kind of grass is greener on the other side look on life. And it can also give a sense of perspective, a reality check, an insight into realising how lucky and perhaps how grateful we should be for the things that we have. I consider myself fortunate to have tasted both scenarios. There's been so many times that I've boarded a flight to the other side of the world with nothing but a credit card and a bullet point list of things that I'd like to see over a few weeks. No strict agenda, just living life as it comes, day by day, taking me wherever things go. And sometimes a holiday or a break is just the medicine that we need. But I've also seen how lonely a life can be on the road, and that when we try to escape from the very things that we wish weren't there, they can somehow end up travelling with us without realising, and that most of what we run from can, in fact, be deep inside our minds. So as much as I'll always encourage anyone to travel, to go find themselves, to see other parts of the world, I also know that it takes a certain type of person, someone who is strong, someone who is bold and fearless, to make it through the emotional challenges as well as the physical challenges that travelling can bring. So hence, when I met today's FinPod guest, I was equally bowled over by her sunny disposition and bright look at life. And I was also horrified by some of the things that she's seen and had to be a part of whilst exploring the world in her own way. You see, volunteering in humanitarian aid work definitely isn't for the faint-hearted. Particularly if you're a nurse, like Karen, then you're on hand to help with the medical side. That's life, it's death, and all the messy bits in between. So when Karen and I sat down to do this interview, we'd only met 2 hours previously. It was by complete chance that through a Twitter introduction, an email, and then me walking through her door at 10 a.m. on a Saturday morning that we came to meet. So the conversation you hear us having is one of our first, but one I hope is the first of many, as I think you'll hear how quickly we get to know each other despite being strangers. I will warn you that there are moments where we talk about topics which aren't so suitable if young children are listening nearby, so it might be best for you to listen in headphones. So meet Karen for the first time, just like I did when I recorded this, and hear how her fuck it moments have changed the course of her 20s and 30s with stories from afar.
From when I was younger, I always knew I wanted to do something to help people, but I was never quite certain what that was going to be. As I got a bit older, I realised I was interested in the health side of things. So I started looking into different healthcare professions, did some work experience. But I always knew that I wanted to go overseas to help people. And I, for as long as I can ever remember, I always wanted to go abroad. And I used to be obsessed with watching programs like Comic Relief, just with utter fascination. And also had this huge desire that I always wanted to go and travel the world, but never thought I was brave enough. And then I started my nurse training. And I remember it was one of the first lectures I went to. And this girl was on the other side of the room telling us, we were introducing ourselves, and she was telling us that she'd been working in Australia driving a tractor on a banana farm. And I thought, I really like that girl. I really want to talk to her about traveling. And she's now one of my best friends. We linked up and we went traveling together after we qualified as nurses before we started working. We went on a 3-month adventure through America, Belize, Guatemala and Mexico. I met a real kindred spirit who completely fueled my wanderlust. And thereafter I became a nurse, and I realised that it would be great to be able to combine the two things I loved, which were nursing and travelling, and also revisit that sort of lifelong desire to go and work abroad, you know, a little bit stereotypical at the time. I want to go to Africa and I want to help people. Never really, you know, quite knew what it entailed, but was quite keen to do that. And here I am 20 years later, you know, since starting out on my A-levels, that here I am now managing to combine those three things that I love into doing different things.
It's like your badge of honour. You've got a few passport stamps to show.
Absolutely.
One of the things that you have done is do so much humanitarian work. Just reel off in your bullet point list, your tick list, your badges of honour, if that's the phrase for humanitarian work, of some of the things that you've seen, and then perhaps we can go into detail of some of those.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to work in many different places in the world. I've worked on some development projects in Uganda. I've done disaster response, so went to the Philippines with the UK medical team after Typhoon Haiyan in 2013. I've done some training in Malawi and India in healthcare settings there. I've worked on the Ebola crisis in Sierra Leone, and more recently worked on the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean.
I mean, that's incredible. What is it within you that says, yeah, I'm going to do this? Because not everybody does. That in itself is a fuck it moment, isn't it? It's a pretty scary thing to go from watching a few pieces on news to actually suddenly being knee deep in whatever you've got to deal with and being on the ground and being the one that's responsible for making a difference.
Well, my first experience was working in a hospital in northern Uganda, and throughout my life having thought, it's work I really want to do. And then when I arrived in Uganda and started working in the hospital there, I just had this moment of thinking, I love my job. And it made me want to just keep going and get different experiences and different opportunities. And I did a master's in humanitarian aid, and that drove me on even more. And all the different experiences have just been phenomenal. Being able to help somebody at a moment of absolute need and desperation, be it that they've been struck by a sudden onset disaster or that they're in a crisis situation. When you can help somebody at that most vulnerable point in their life, it's a real privilege. Mm. And you have to think that, what if you were in that situation? You would really hope there were people that would reach out and help you. Mm. And I'm very fortunate that I've been in those situations to be able to help, and then as a nurse as well, to be able to use my technical expertise to help people, as well as draw on all my different experiences. It's quite phenomenal.
Tell me about Karen the person. So when we take the nurse out of you and this humanitarian side, what kind of fuels you?
I'm just a very, very normal person. I have an amazing husband. I have a brilliant life here in Manchester. I just like to mix things up a little bit. I like to maybe break the mold. I'm always looking for a new opportunity. I'm inspired by people around me, and I hope that I can inspire other people as well. So it's a two-way process. So I always like a challenge.
You've seemed very positive, considering some of the things that you've seen and some of the desperation that you've seen. You seem very positive.
Yeah, I guess I probably am. But, you know, some of the people I've worked with in places, like for example, Uganda, are just some of the most amazing people I've ever met. You know, the most inspiring people. They're living in absolute poverty. They have nothing. You know, they've been through civil war, and they are the most upbeat, fantastic people I've worked with. When I was in the Philippines after the typhoon, you know, there's such a positive attitude towards getting life back together, rebuilding your home, rebuilding your community. And, you know, that when you see people in those situations that can remain positive, you have to be positive yourself. You have to be grateful. And when you've been away and you've been working in these environments and you come home, it's often the most simple things that are the best pleasures in life. A walk around the park, a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, just to sit in peace and quiet in your home. You know, normal life becomes very underrated.
Yeah, I bet. So there have been several key moments for you, haven't there, where you've kind of had to make decisions, one of which was when you walked away from quite a stable job within the NHS and decided to go and help out in the Ebola crisis. Not typical Monday for most people, I imagine, but talk about some of the kind of decision as to why you did that, and also perhaps the response of other people knowing that you were doing that kind of fuck it mentality and switching things up, because not everybody gets it, let's be frank.
No, it was a real life-changing moment for me, actually. I'd worked for the NHS for 15 years as a nurse, and I just kept feeling like there was something missing. And I'd been involved, I'd taken a career break, I'd gone to Uganda, I'd been involved in a disaster response team going to the Philippines after the typhoon, and I was doing some consultancy for a charity involved in the Ebola crisis. And I got the opportunity to go and pursue this work full time with a base in the UK with some travel overseas. And it meant giving up my permanent contract in the NHS. And people's reactions to that were, why would you do this? Why would you give up a stable, permanent job? You have a good pension, you have a good holiday allowance, you have a comfortable working environment. Why would you give all this up? And I was quite shocked at the attitudes of people to, why would you do this, as opposed to my attitude that's always been, well, why not? Mm-hmm. And I always knew that the NHS is always going to be there. I can always go back. And this was an opportunity that I wanted to grasp with both hands. And I didn't want to look back staying in the NHS as a nurse thinking, what if? I thought, well, I'd rather go for it. And if it doesn't work out, I'll go back to the NHS, or there will always be opportunities within the NHS, mm-hmm. great opportunities like I'd already had. And I don't ever regret that. It was one of the best decisions I ever made. Mm. I've now gone back to the NHS, and I bring back all these experiences. And I just think how fantastically lucky I am that I've had these opportunities, and I went out and had some fantastic life-changing opportunities from stepping away from my comfortable NHS job at the time.
Mm. Stepping out your comfort zone, it's interesting, isn't it? You picked up on a few phrases which I really believe in there. The why not kind of phrase is quite important, isn't it? And people that know me will know that I've also at many stages throughout my 20s walked away from really stable jobs, changed career 3 times because something within me thought, I'm not getting what I need to out of this. I need to make a change. So I definitely understand the pressure that you feel under yourself, but also you care what other people think sometimes, and you've just got to go for it, haven't you? Although you've got all these amazing experiences, there were also times that probably you saw life at and just things at its worst as well. Let's tap into more recent experience of some of the work that you've done. So you were working out with an NGO, on board search and rescue work, weren't you, out on some of the ships, looking at the migrant and immigration situations. And this is a subject which it dominates the news and has dominated the agenda here in the UK for so long because of Brexit, because of general election. How did it come around, and what information were you given before you even left UK soil?
So I had the opportunity to go and work with a non-governmental organisation on the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. So predominantly people fleeing Libya to try and get across the water to Italy on small boats that weren't fit for purpose. So my role with the charity I was working with was to try and save lives at sea. And it was an eye-opening experience. We were very well briefed before we left the shores of Italy to engage in this response. But you learn so much more from rescuing people from all sorts of different countries about their situation. I thought I was going in with my eyes very wide open, But subsequently, my eyes were opened a whole lot more. You're hearing the first-hand stories of why somebody's fled their country. Maybe they weren't even intending to come to Europe, but the situation for them has become so dangerous that that's become an only option, is to try and cross, make a very perilous journey across the sea. People fleeing famine, torture, detention, civil war, dictatorships, extreme poverty beyond anything that we can comprehend, just in search of a safe and better life, probably a standard of life that we wouldn't even maybe want to entertain, but they just want safety. Mm. And it's when you hear these stories firsthand, it is a real eye-opener. And the situation surrounding migration, immigration, whatever terms people put on this, is people often have very black and white views, and people often have very, very strong views. And I think there are a million shades of grey in the situation. And it's very easy to be have a strong opinion or be very opinionated for or against it. But I think my outlook was that if I could even change one person's view on the situation for the better and open people's eyes to some of people's situations, or be the voice of people's stories that we've helped, then I've done my job.
What was the first rescue mission like for you, and what happened?
The first rescue mission, like all of them, there was no one typical rescue mission. You are finding people, men, women, children, unaccompanied minors. They've left the shores of Libya, often at the hands of human traffickers that charge anything from £500 to £1,500 for people to get on these small boats that are not fit for purpose. They're told these boats will make it across the Italian shores. The likelihood is these boats are going to reach about 15 nautical miles and they're going to sink. You know, these are flimsy rubber boats or overpacked wooden boats with a huge risk of capsize. And these vessels are going to go down. And when you make a rescue and you look at these people, they're normal people like you and me. You know, some of these people have been nurses, they've been doctors, so I can relate to them very much, you know. And the situation in their home country has deteriorated or become so politically unstable that they've had to flee. And I looked at these people on the deck sometimes thinking they could have drowned. Mm-hmm. These people could have been in those statistics of the people that are drowned. And it's an overwhelming feeling to know that those people are safely on your ship. You've managed to save them from drowning. Mm-hmm. And that's massively overwhelming, rewarding. Sometimes you can't even get your head around the fact that people are in this situation.
I mean, you mentioned about mothers, seeing mothers with their children. And I think you'd said previously when we were talking off air about how it's dangerous for an adult to do that, but for a mother to think that things were so bad and so desperate to take her children and risk that, and how difficult that is to comprehend for someone.
Absolutely. And I recall a moment when I was on the ship. We didn't have very good internet, but I recall a friend sending me through a photograph of her nursery. She was due to give birth, and this nursery looked absolutely stunning. And that very same day then, we made a rescue, and there was a mother with a baby who was under a week old. And I couldn't help but stop and have a moment where I absolutely broke my heart thinking how worlds apart the entry into the world was going to be for my friend's baby versus this woman who'd given birth in a Libyan detention centre. less than a week old and was making this journey out to sea with no guarantee they were going to survive, and also no belongings, and not knowing what they were going to go, what was going to happen to them on their onward journey. On another occasion, you know, we had heavily pregnant women on board the ship, and there was a child born on the ship as well. So it beggars belief to think that the start these people have in life, but the comfort that you take from those situations is thinking, well, at least they're coming to Europe and hopefully they'll have access to healthcare facilities and they'll have a better life.
Mm. And we say hopefully, don't we? But we know that the situation is always politically driven, and that's never always the end of a story. When someone arrives, it's not like a taste of heaven of arriving in Garden Eden or however people want to perceive it. It's not quite the fantasy that they hope that they're getting to. One of the jobs that you had to do, which I find extraordinary to even get my head round, was finding some of the dead bodies that were in the sea. You call the sea, between your colleagues, almost like a graveyard, really, of the people who, the bodies that you did find, but then how many more bodies were there in the sea that you didn't ever find? Just talk about what that was like. And also, I understand that there was a human aspect to how you treated those bodies in the final phase of their life or their passing.
So our response was search and rescue, or SAR as we would abbreviate it to. But very often we would all comment on it was search and rescue and retrieval, because it was always a very sobering moment that these boats would go down, people would drown. The statistic in the first quarter of the year was over 1,000 people had drowned trying to make that journey. And you find a body in the water and the body has begun to decompose. You don't know who this person is, yet you are in a position that you can try and give this person some dignity in their final stage of life. You can get them out of the water. You can hold a few quiet moments on deck with your team where you can say some words, you can read a poem. For religious people, they can pray, and you take that body over to Italy where it will be buried, and you hope against all hopes that maybe that person might be identified, because that person, it always struck me, that person is somebody's sister, it could be somebody's mother, it's somebody's daughter, it's somebody's friend, it could be somebody's colleague. And you really hope that, as distressing as it is for that family, they find out what happened to their relative, that it wasn't just a case of a missing person, that the family can have some closure on what happened to that individual.
Tell me about some of the people that you were working with, the other humanitarian workers, because I imagine you guys must have become pretty close in a circumstance like this, and even not necessarily with the charity that you were working for, but other charities as well who were out on different vessels. That kind of common purpose that you had must have really made you connect to those people in a way that you probably might not connect with people who know you back home.
You do inevitably form close bonds with the people you're working with, because you're all in a situation that people often don't understand, or they weren't there. And I've had that in all the humanitarian missions that I've worked on. And I have some of the best friends from my times of working overseas, from when I first went out to Uganda back in 2009, right up to this day. Some of the people I call my closest or best friends are people I've worked with overseas. Mm-hmm.
Not everybody was necessarily supportive, though, were they? As you kind of went through this process of some of the work that you and the other NGOs were doing, even when you went onto Italian soil for a down day, you weren't always met with such a supportive response, were you?
No, and immigration is a topic that seems to spark very strong feelings in people, particularly, you know, in Italy. It was a very controversial subject, and there was a lot of ill feeling towards the non-governmental organisations that were bringing people onto land. One particular incident I recall is coming off the ship onto land, and a gentleman, a local Italian man, asking about the ship and what we were doing. And when I explained, he actually spat on the floor in front of me and told us we were doing terrible work and to get on the ship and leave. And this is something I've never experienced before in all my work overseas. When I worked on the Ebola crisis, you know, often you tell people I work on the Ebola crisis and people would step away from you like you had the disease. But people were always very empathetic towards people in difficult situations, whereas this situation, people weren't so empathetic. You did get people that supported you, you know, that's not to deny that, but you also got people that really didn't agree with what you were doing, and that added a very different dynamic, particularly when you'd done a difficult rescue or you'd retrieved dead bodies from the water, and then to be met with hostility just compounded the difficulty of a challenging job.
How do you... It's hard to kind of summarise, isn't it? But when you come back to normality, you know, when you came back to the UK, for instance, and then try to explain these experiences to people, is it something that you can explain, and how does that impact you when you've got all this knowledge, but it's hard to explain and convey that to someone, isn't it?
We always call it reverse culture shock when you come back from any kind of humanitarian project. And, you know, all the things that you used to take for granted, like going to the pub or going shopping, those things suddenly feel overwhelming because you've been living quite a simple life. You've been seeing things that people don't comprehend. And through no fault of anybody, people expect you to be able to summarize your experience maybe in a sentence or two. And sometimes it's actually quite hard to find the words to explain what you've been dealing with. And people, you know, I recall coming back from Uganda and people said, was it lovely? Or I came back from the Philippines after the typhoon and people said, what's the worst thing you saw? And I wondered, how do you quantify that? Do you quantify it in the number of dead bodies that you saw? Do you quantify it in the number of houses that have been devastated or personal belongings lost? And sometimes those questions are hard to give an answer to, and at the same time you understand that people genuinely want to know about your experience, but they don't know how to find the right questions to ask you to ask about it. So it can be quite difficult to try and sort of relay these experiences, but there are so many people that are interested and want to know, want to ask questions, and it is an amazing position to be in that you can share those experiences, you can be the voice of people, you can share your view of it. And that's always great when you come home, is to be able to tell those stories and share those experiences.
I mean, it sounds a bit like, you know, the army going out to a war zone, really. Then when you know, the soldiers come back to normal life, so to speak, they just have to kind of carry on and, you know, go and see the family and go around to the mother-in-laws. And it's, you know, the idea of returning to normal life when you've experienced that is difficult. Obviously, the situation in the UK has been quite politically charged around migration. And I know that you found, even just reading on posts on social media about this, the misinformation around the situations and the places that you've been, from people just not necessarily knowing what was really happening, and quite a lot of the hostility on social media as well. It was something that you found difficult to just get your head around, really.
Yeah, I had to actually stop myself reading comments that people would put under social media posts, for example, on Twitter, because it shocked me. really how nasty people could be. Comments like, let them drown. And I was thinking, you know, how on earth can anybody ever in this whole world have that attitude towards people? How can you be so full of hatred? And I used to think to myself how easy it would be to sit in your humble abode in front of a laptop being a keyboard warrior, when the reality of the situation was so, so different. And also, I think some of it is very much a lack of understanding of the situations. And it made me sort of feel quite determined to try and open people's eyes to the situations, that it wasn't a black and white situation, that I wanted to help educate people about the situations that people were coming from, the situations people had seen, and just be a voice for some people.
What was... Are there a handful of moments that over the last 10 years that really stand out to you? Either moments where you've really made a difference to someone or you've been unable to. What are those?
There's been so many moments over the years, and it doesn't have to be anything profound that you do to help somebody, you know, and that's the same as working as an emergency department nurse in the NHS. It doesn't necessarily have to be the most profound action that has the biggest impact. It might just be something as simple as making somebody a cup of tea. When I worked in Uganda, it was as simple as getting bed numbers behind the beds on the ward, and to know that 5 years later they were still there helping to contribute towards the system. So sometimes, you know, there might be certain individuals that you've helped in a sudden onset disaster that really stand out in your mind. It might just be the moment that you've shared as you've sat in a slum in India, sharing that moment with somebody and having a discussion about their life. It might be that individual in Sierra Leone that tells you that your presence in their country during an Ebola crisis means that the world hasn't forgotten them. And sometimes it can just be the smallest things. When I worked on the rescue ship, I was on a night duty and I was talking with one of the rescued women. And she asked me if I had children and I told her no. I hoped I was blessed one day. And I asked her about her children because there was no children with her. And she told me that she'd become separated from her young twins. And they were 2 years of age and they'd been separated in a detention centre in Libya. And she knew that her children had made it safely to Europe. And she had a phone number for somebody that they were with. And she was hoping to be reunited. And we were so fortunate on the vessel that we had a good child protection team who were able to speak to this woman and find out her circumstance. And the hope was that she would be reunited with her children on land at some point. Never an easy situation and not straightforward as it sounds by any stretch of the imagination. But for a mother to have been parted from her two-year-old twins, mm-hmm. and I have nieces who are twins who were the same age at the time, and I couldn't even imagine my sister-in-law being parted from them. Mm-hmm. And that's a moment that will stay with me, because I just think, what if I'd not had that conversation with that woman at 4 a.m?
But also, you don't know the end of that story, you know? And that hard bit for those is that then you kind of, the wonder of what if, what happened next? And part of the things that you do in helping these people is it is quite... you know, transient, isn't it? It's quite fluid. So you kind of have these moments, but you never get to follow through. It's not like you both say, oh, add me on Facebook. Well, I'll drop you a message next week and catch up with you. It's not that kind of situation. The subject of women is a really important subject in this situation. I know you said a lot of people ask, why is it so many men are coming to the shores? The idea of the survival of the fittest, but you really saw firsthand of the difficulties that women were facing and some of the places they were ending up and what was really happening to them. Are you able to talk about some of the kind of stories that you heard as you did this work?
We heard a lot of distressing stories from women, particularly working as a nurse, the women that would seek help from us as a medical team. And some of these women would be pregnant as a result of rape. Some of these women would be suffering sexual transmitted diseases or displaying symptoms of sexually transmitted diseases because of sexual aggression and violence. Women have very difficult... Women that are making a journey face a very, very dangerous situation. And a huge number of them had been reported to have been sexually attacked. Equally, a large number of women were also being trafficked as sex slaves. And the reality for them when they arrive in Europe is that they will be sold on as sex slaves, as prostitutes. And that's the fate that lay in store for many of these women. And that was heartbreaking to know that that potentially could be happening with these women, particularly the younger women on board who were looking forward to a life in Europe, and you just knew that there was a very difficult path potentially lying ahead for them. It's not to say that was the fate of every woman that was on board, but we knew that that was a real risk for some of the young women or the unaccompanied minors.
I know it wasn't necessarily easy for men as well. There was one evening where you kind of just stood and observed the people who were on your ship and saw two men from Bangladesh cuddled up next to each other. I guess you don't know if they were brothers, if they were related, if they were friends, or they were just so desperate that they just needed to be close to somebody. I mean, there must have been many times where you kind of just stood back, took a moment, took a few breaths and just thought, this is the picture of what's happening right now.
Absolutely. As we would be coming into port and people would start to see land, there was often jubilation on deck. People would be singing and they'd be dancing. And it was a double-edged sword, because absolutely, it was brilliant that we were getting to land and they'd made the journey safely. But equally, you knew that upon arriving on land was not going to be easy for them, and that arriving on land was the first of many, many, many hurdles and potentially a very, very long journey. It's not a case of arrive on land, you're registered, you're a refugee and you can do what you want. The process of seeking refugee status can take years and then be denied and people be sent back to their countries. And you knew that there was a very difficult road ahead, probably for the majority of people that we rescued. And so you sort of had this double-edged sword of thinking, you haven't drowned, you've made it to land safely, but I don't know what path lies ahead for you now. I don't know what your fate is. I don't know where you're going to end up. I don't know if you're going to be reunited with your family members. And that often left a pang in your heart.
A couple of years ago, I, by complete chance, as it always seems to be with these interviews, I ended up going round to the house of a Libyan family living in Manchester. And they were being supported by a local mosque. And they had travelled just, the mother, there were three children, and the mother, at the time they had escaped Libya, was 8 months pregnant. So she lied to travel. She said that she was only 6 months pregnant. And after 3 years of living in the UK, they were about to be evicted from their fifth house. And when I went to the house to see them, the mother just fell on her knees and broke down. And she didn't know who I was. She was just happy to see somebody. And, I hugged her and I took her into the room, and there was nothing in this house. And the landlord was evicting them because they were on benefits and because they were foreign and they weren't allowed to live there. And it was a really desperate situation. But eventually, when I calmed down the mother and just sat with her and whilst a little baby played around, and there wasn't even seats. We sat on the floor. There was no carpet. There was nothing. There was no food or anything. It was desperate. And they'd been in the UK for 3 years. And she told me about the journey that they'd had to make to get over. And they were lucky because she had somewhere along the lines, she had a British relative, and that gave them the card to get into Britain. But they talked about how, when they were living in Libya, how life was before the war, how it was a very open nation. You know, you would walk down the road and there'd be fruit on the trees and you could take it. They didn't really have taxes. You didn't really have to pay a lot for electricity or gas. The schools were free. Everything was free and everyone had a good quality of life. They were nurses, they were doctors, they were teachers, exactly as you said. And then suddenly when things started to change politically, how she said the lowest moment was when they were in one bedroom. They only lived in one room in the house at the worst point. And they were being bombed by everybody, even the UN. And she was pregnant. She was told if she didn't get out of the situation, her baby would die. Her two other children had gone out to play with their friends, how, I don't know, and had found a load of bullet casings and a decapitated head. And it completely ruined them. So they knew they had to get out of the situation. And it took years to get to Manchester. And when they got to Manchester, at the point I saw them 3 years later, they were about to be evicted again. They'd been begging on the streets. Her children were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, having had to learn a new language, go into school. They'd been spat at, they'd been abused on the streets of Manchester. And her husband, from stress, couldn't hold down a job and he'd just been diagnosed with cancer. So you kind of think that was 3 years on from perhaps some of the situation where you were seeing, and it really, it opens your eyes, doesn't it, to the absolute desperation that, when does this end? And all she wanted, you know, having had that kind of life where she lived next door to all of her family, her sisters, her brothers, she had no idea where they were. Her family who had stayed there had died. That's all she knew. She didn't know how they died, didn't know what happened to their bodies. How you can just go from knowing, you know, having, you know, a normal Sunday where you all get together and have that Sunday dinner, to me and her sat on the floor. And I've never really seen anyone cry to a stranger out of such desperation. But, you know, as a journalist, it was one of those moments that it broke my heart. And it was just by complete randomness that the mosque had given me her address and said, we're trying to help this family all that we can. Why don't you go and meet with her? And she just had enough that day and I walked through the door. But to know that, and I lost contact with her and so did the mosque, so I don't know what happened to her next. And these are the things that play on your mind. They're real people. You've held their hands, you've heard their story, you've looked into their eyes. And in a way she felt torn because she thought that by coming to the UK, her God had given her a second chance at life. But then she also felt angry that that chance that she thought that she had, all her hopes for just doing anything to protect her children, meant that they were still struggling and they still weren't able to make ends meet. I find that really difficult. And did you, after that particular story, and I've worked on other cases where I've been into asylum refuges and seen and worked with people like that, in the nature of what I do as a journalist. But I'd cried all the way home after that because I just felt quite helpless, actually, that I didn't know what to do to help that situation. And there wasn't necessarily anything politically that I could do. But were there times where you did cry, or the emotion was quite overwhelming for you?
Absolutely. I think we're only a human being, and in my day-to-day job as a nurse in the emergency department, there are so many times that move me to tears. And I think we're only human beings, and I think you'd have to have cast iron heart if the things that you hear and see don't move you, if stories don't stay with you. And I can say that from my whole career, from everywhere I've worked in the world, be it here in the UK or overseas, there are so many people and so many stories that have struck me and hearing about people's experiences. But one of the things that I always think is such a privilege is that people are willing to share those stories with you. You know, these are people that are vulnerable and they've built a trust in you and they trust you with what they're telling you. Mm. And I always find that quite humbling that people have opened up to you. And, you know, that's not easy for some people. And in other people, they maybe can't find the words, but that you can see it in their actions, you can see it in their body language. Mm. And absolutely, I think I've cried a river over the years.
But what's your outlet? Do you write? Do you draw? How do you kind of process this for you as well, really?
I think there's a number of ways. I mean, you can do things, you can do active things, like you can go out for a run, you can listen to some music. You can actually just take yourself away and reflect on it. You can think about your own life. You can think how you, God forbid, could find yourself in these situations too. You know, there are so many ways. Talking to people about your experiences, writing maybe memoirs to yourself that maybe, you know, they're not for anybody else's eyes, but there are a whole number of ways that you cope. And, you know, many of the organizations that you work for also offer you good psychological support afterwards, so you have got somebody to talk to. But sharing your experiences, I think this comes back to the point of that you end up making such good friends with your team, because there's somebody that's been through the shared experience, there's somebody that understands, there's somebody that you can sit in silence without lots of questions, or there's somebody that you might have shared the smallest moment with. There's somebody you might just drop a text of a phrase that you used to use all the time. And, you know, these things, they really do bring you very, very close to people. And that is a huge source of help.
Well, the podcast obviously is called the Fuck It Moments podcast. If you had to kind of pull out some of your key ones, are there moments or experiences that you've kind of thought, yeah, that was a real pivot for me? That really made me think about things in different. Nothing seemed to be quite the same after that moment.
I think so many, I could probably pull out an example from every country I've worked in the world, including back, you know, including here in the UK. Yeah, a real key pivotal moment for me was having the opportunity to go and work beyond the NHS, to have these experiences. Some of the days we used to say when I worked in Uganda were roller coaster days. You'd have had the best and worst moments all in one day. You could find yourself sitting downstairs in the, you know, hiding in the latrine crying because you just lost a young person. Yet you could go home and sit with your team and share a beer, just sat being munched away by mosquitoes. Yet finding the simplest thing to laugh at. You know, maybe you were laughing hysterically because the electric and the water had gone off for the 10th time that day, or you were celebrating because you'd managed to get some running water. You know, the roller coaster days and the roller coaster moments are there in every bit of the work I've ever done. The highs and lows, you know, you've rescued a boat full of people, you've safely got 600 people out of the water, and then you have the most magnificent sunset. And I remember one key moment on the search and rescue response, and we had done a huge rescue that day, and it was a beautiful sunset, and some dolphins started jumping, and it was just such a key moment. And lots of people had grown to fear the sea because of the experience they just had, and it was just a moment that everybody enjoyed, and people were clapping and smiling. And I hold that moment, I'll never ever forget that moment, because it just showed you that beyond all the difficulties that there had been up to that moment, everybody was suddenly sharing a moment of pleasure, and that was incredible.
What happens next for you? I mean, we're sat on a table here where you've got some of your revision notes. I'm helpfully distracting you from revising. You've clearly got great social circle here. You've got friends who've bought you some beautiful lilies which smell amazing, and you've got your books here. What happens next for you, Karen?
I'm currently training as an advanced clinical practitioner in the emergency department. So right now for me, I've got a couple of years ahead of very intense study with the eventual aim of becoming an autonomous practitioner in the emergency department. But at the same time, I'm still involved with some charities overseas. There's a phenomenal charity that I'm involved with called Medcare that do some work with a children's health centre in southwest Uganda. And they predominantly deal with children with chronic ongoing illness needs. So I'm so fortunate that I can now balance life in the NHS. I can still support projects that I feel really passionate about. And hopefully I can still be in a position to be on a disaster response team should there be a sudden onset disaster somewhere in the world that I will be able to go and respond for a short time.
At what point do you ever just have a normal boring holiday in a caravan in Wales or something like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, boring is so underrated. There's nothing I love more than just taking a walk out with my husband, going for a coffee, a walk in the park, a walk on the beach. Simple pleasures. Absolutely. Yeah, so many simple pleasures give me so much fulfillment as well.
Some of the things that you've talked about today, not everybody is going to go out and, as a result of hearing this interview, drop what they're doing and go and sign up to go and work on a search and rescue mission. But there will be people who think, maybe I should pay attention more to the boat rescues. Maybe I should read up on certain aspects of these stories. If people are interested, they want to help. What small steps can people do who are, living wherever they are listening to this in an ordinary life, if that's the right word, and are intrigued to know more or do a little bit to help?
I always get questions from people about how they can become involved in humanitarian work or on development projects. And it doesn't have to be that you have got 6 months of your life to give up and go and work abroad. I mean, you can be a volunteer from back here in the UK that helps fundraise for organisations, that helps sort out donations, even helping out at your local charity shop. It's part of the bigger picture. If you do want to go out and work overseas, very often you have to be able to commit for 2 or 3 months at a time. And you do have to go as a volunteer in the first instance, because you need to be able to take some experience with you if you go to work for a bigger organisation. There are smaller organisations here in the UK that do train people up, particularly healthcare professionals. And there's an organisation called UK Med who train up healthcare professionals here in the UK that can be on short disaster response teams. Should an onset disaster occur, or a crisis occurs somewhere that needs some support from UK healthcare professionals. I always say to people that networking is always really good. Go and talk to people, go to events, go and hear people speak about their experiences, learn languages, go on training courses, as many as you can, to learn about working with non-governmental organisations or work overseas, because it's not a case of applying our NHS principles overseas. It doesn't work. It's a two-way learning process. I learn as much from my overseas colleagues as they probably do from me. So it's not a case of me just imparting my knowledge because I know better because I come from the UK. I've learned equally as much, or if not more, I'm sure, than I've been able to give. So you can never underestimate the value of what you can do to help back here in the UK, and even helping with projects back here in the UK. You know, there are so many good projects, homelessness projects, befriending, all these things there is so much, if you can't volunteer your services overseas, there is so much you can do to help back here in your own community. So it's worth looking on social forums to see which organisations do need that help. It might be going and making the cups of tea at a social fundraising event, or something as simple as that, or sort, like I say, sorting through donations, because not all donations are the most appropriate donations. So there is so much people can do, and the internet is a brilliant forum for that, and local community social sites as well.
All right, well, thank you for your conversation on a Saturday, and I'll let you continue with your studies.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to my conversation with Karen O'Neill, a humanitarian worker and nurse living in Manchester. The Fuck It Moments podcast is brought to you by A Small Furry Bear Productions and is hosted by me, Claire Freeman. The music is by Thomas Ragsdale, and you can send in your stories to finpod@gmail.com.